Welcome to ESIP's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I am talking to Dalibor Rohak. Dalibor is a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., where he focuses on European politics and economics. He has written extensively about the EU and the backsliding of countries in the former Soviet bloc. He's now finishing his new book called In Defense of Globalism, which is due to be released later this year. Today, I would like to talk to Dalibor about ideas and the ideas fueling populism and nationalism and anti-globalism on both sides of the pond, and how Dalibor see the prospects for liberal democracy and the European Union. We're also going to talk a little bit about Emmanuel Macron and the upcoming election to the European Parliament. Dalibor, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Frederick.
So there's many things I'd like to talk to you about, but I wanted us to start to discuss a little bit about ideas, and in particular, what ideas that have been fueling the backlash to globalization. And what has occupied you in much of your thinking and writing lately isn't so much the backlash on the left, say the rise of political leaders like Jeremy Corbyn, who sounds very much like the anti-globalization movement that took to the streets in the noughties and ravaged cities like Seattle and Genoa. You now seem far more worried about developments on the right and what has happened in political parties like the Republican Party in the United States and some of the center-right parties in Europe that previously were pretty firmly on the side of economic liberalism, but that now are flirting with anti-liberal economic and political thoughts. So what has happened?
Right, so I wouldn't say that the left doesn't have a problem of this kind. Of course it does. The thing is that I'm a man of the political right, so to speak. I was brought up in the 1990s reading Friedrich von Hayek and looking up to figures like Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And I am deeply worried about the right sort of straying away from those principles. I was educated as an economist. I worked at the Cato Institute, and my hesitations about the right approach to international affairs really started around the time of the Maidan in Ukraine and Russia's invasion of Eastern Ukraine, annexation of Crimea, where I saw on full display this realist attitude that you find very often in libertarian circles in the United States. At that time, in 2014, that sort of crude realism and disregard for international institutions and rules of the game has been confined to libertarian circles. But with the election of Donald Trump and the sort of populist upsurge across the West, I think it has come to dominate the discussion, especially on the GOP side of the spectrum in the United States, but also in other European countries. And I think that this is indicative to some extent of a deeper blind spot on the free market right, on the political right, which really turns the focus of the discussion away from these international geopolitical underpinnings of the free market liberal order. And what I would like to do through my work is to revive some of these ideas. So an earlier generation of free market economists were very well aware of this blind spot and try to rectify it. The 1938 Lippmann colloquium in Paris was very much organized around this idea of international federalism and the need for rules of the game that would constrain states. And so my work really is trying to revive some of these ideas, bring them back into the conversation on the free market right, because I think they are going to be critical in answering the populist challenge that we are facing at the moment.
So would you make a difference between the development of the ideas that you're talking about now and populism of the kind that we're seeing in America now? Or are there interlinkages between them that perhaps are more interesting than the differences between them?
There certainly are interlinkages, Perhaps one way to think about this is that politics and policy positions that people take are very often downstream from sort of deeper cultural attitudes. And that seems to be a sort of zero-sum undercurrent in people's thinking at any point in time. And that zero-sum undercurrent, sort of tribalist, particularist attitude, I think resurfaces in specific historic moments. And over the past decade, we've seen a perfect storm of factors from, you know, the Iraq war, through the financial crisis, through structural changes in Western economies, a productivity slowdown, culminating with the migration or refugee crisis in 2015, which really contributed to this narrative that the world is zero-sum, the political elites are corrupt and incompetent, and as a result, we should go to a much simpler world in which people or politicians speaking on behalf of the people will somehow reassert control of nation states and sort of restore this sort of more soothing, simpler world. And I'm just saying that's not on the menu, that option, really. And what it risks doing is making the world much less safe and much poorer. The problem is that mainstream politics, as of now, doesn't really have very good answers to these grievances that have driven this populist upsurge. There really aren't very good antibodies against these bad ideas that are out there. And I think the primary challenge for classical liberals, libertarians, neoliberals, if you will, is to make sort of more serious intellectual investment that will hopefully pay off in the future.
Yeah. And to continue on the same topic a little bit more and perhaps turn to Europe, what are the roots of the ideas that you're seeing evolving here on the center-right that, you know, can be classified in different ways? But one way, of course, is that they are different from the ones that were heralded in previous decades.
I think what we're seeing is not just the temporary blip where some of this sort of zero-sum mentality would sort of resurface, but it's really about a deeper political realignment where these issues of openness versus closedness, cosmopolitanism versus national identity are sort of reorganizing our political parties, both on the political left and right. What that means is that the big versus small government divide, in a way, is much less important than it was 15, 20 years ago. So you know, when you watched the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington last week, there was a lot of talk about socialism and the threat, supposed threat of sort of planned economy coming from the Democratic left. And yes, there are people on the Democratic left who call themselves socialists, but there really isn't that much substance in those labels. The threat to America is not a planned economy. I can talk about sort of policy specifics, but it's sort of hard to sort of organize and rally people around these causes that sort of animated the Reaganite right of the 1980s. What really resonates in instead is the sort of distinction between cosmopolitan urban elites and sort of rural, more particularist outlooks that other people have. And I think that's the divide that's going to define politics for the years to come. I think the place of classical liberals is on the cosmopolitan side, but it needs to be matched with ideas and policies and attitudes that do not drive the rest of our countrymen away. I think that's the challenge of the moment.
Yeah. And how would you weigh up Brexit and the opinions leading to Brexit in sort of this line of thought that you have? So, are we talking about sort of Brexit essentially being driven by the same sentiments, or are we talking about something else here?
I see Brexit as part of the same picture, both as a sort of symptom and as a catalyst of some of these dynamics. So, of course, I'm sure as you do, I have many friends on the free market right who supported Brexit ahead of the 2016 referendum. I was skeptical. I didn't really see much of an upside in leaving the European Union. At the same time, I was not inherently offended by the idea. There are many different positions one could take with relations to the EU, and the country can be part of the single market, not being part of the EU. Within the EU, there are various modalities. You don't have to be in the Eurozone, you don't have to be in Schengen, etc., etc. So making a sort of adjustment in that space didn't strike me as sort of, you know, beyond the pale or sort of inherent threat to the liberal order. The problem is that since the referendum, the conversation has become much more radicalized in the UK. So now we are not talking about a sort of adjustment at the margin that would maybe give more control to Westminster at the expense of deeper economic integration within the single market. But we are now talking about a no-deal Brexit as the only possible way, as the only thing that would be compatible with the mandate created by that referendum. And I think that is regrettable, and that is going to potentially cause damage both to the British economy, to the European economy, and we've already seen it catalyze these political dynamics. So you have the creation of the independent group with both Labour and Tory MPs joining those who are uncomfortable with the sort of extremist positions, or what would have been extremist positions only a few months ago, taken by their own parties on this issue. And I think there is also a lot of sort of worrying dynamics within the Tory party with this sort of former UKIPers joining and potentially pulling the party further in that direction. So I think we are seeing, I think Steve Davis from the Institute of Economic Affairs has written about this extensively. We really are seeing a sort of reorganization of British politics, if you will, that's been catalyzed by Brexit. Maybe this was coming anyway, but I think it's going to shape British and European politics for years to come.
And if we then move from the UK and talk a little bit more about the Central and Eastern European countries, I think one way to categorize the debate in Brussels, or the analysis in Brussels, is that there is this growing sentiment, or indeed growing fear, that we may have entered sort of a period where there is almost a degree of inevitability that many of these countries are now moving into a different political orbit that simply isn't going to be compatible with staying in the European Union. Would you sort of share that analysis, or do you think the developments are a bit more mixed?
First of all, when I look back at the experience of Central and Eastern European countries after 1990, especially in the case of those that ended up joining NATO and the EU, what I see is predominantly a success story. Look at Poland today and compare it with Ukraine, starting from the same position in 1990. Poland is now, depending on the measure you use, 3 to 5 times wealthier in per capita terms than Ukraine. I mean, all of these places are just much better places, much better societies to live in than they were 30 years ago. So I would not paint this picture in overly pessimistic terms. At the same time, I think there was an illusion in the 1990s that we sort of knew what the direction of progress was. We knew, you know, what course the history was going to take, and that was really illusory. And so many people have been caught off guard by the development in Hungary and Poland in the past decade, thinking that such reversals and sort of embrace of authoritarian practices were no longer thinkable in the European space. Well, that proved to be a mistake. At the same time, I think it's worth stressing that Hungary and Poland are in many ways special cases. They are not illustrative of the wider class of problems afflicting Central Eastern European countries, most communist economies. And, you know, everywhere you'll find corruption, everywhere you'll find this nexus of money and politics, but the sort of hybrid regime style authoritarianism that government and ruling political party taking over media and the judiciary and just tweaking the rules of the game in ways that benefit them. You haven't really found that, you can't really find it anywhere else in that extent, the same extent as in Hungary and Poland. And the other mistake that I think people make is that they oftentimes conflate the sort of social and cultural conservatism of these societies with the authoritarian dynamics that we see in Poland and Hungary. And I think that's not being really helpful if we are trying to pull these countries away from the allure of authoritarianism and also from the attraction that Russia to some extent exercises in the region. So I think it's really worth distinguishing between Viktor Orban's embrace of, you know, whether it's sincere or not is another question, but I think we need to distinguish between his embrace of traditional Christian values and his rejection of immigration and set that aside from what he's doing to the rule of law, and he's monopolized the media space and like, you know, rewrite the rules of the political game and so on and so forth. And I haven't really seen that distinction being made very clearly in Brussels, and I think it's something that should worry us.
Yeah, I mean, you can, if you take a book like Ivan Krastev's book After Europe, which is a book that has been highly regarded by lots of people in the capitals of Europe that are worried about the development of Eastern and Central European countries. One takeaway point from that book could perhaps be that there is a cultural dimension to at least the awkwardness that some of these countries have in the relation with the European Union. I think it was Adam Michnik who once said about Poland that there is sort of an inferiority, superiority complex in how they relate to the rest of the world. And I was just thinking when I listened to what you were saying, so what do you make of Krastev's argument about more of a cultural problem in many of these countries when it comes to assessing their own position, not just vis-a-vis Brussels and other countries, but their position sort of in the broader process of economic and social modernization?
I have to confess that I haven't read Krastev's book, but that cultural dimension strikes me as really important. It's not a coincidence that one of the issues that made the most headway in get the most traction in public discussions in Central Europe is this question of quality of sort of food products. So, you know, under the same brand name, the stuff that's being sold in, say, Germany tends to be different than the stuff that's being sold in Central Europe. And people have like looked at, you know, Nutella and various brands of olive oil and so on and so forth. And so that really resonated with the sense that some people in Central Europe have of being second-class citizens within the European Union. The answer to that, which I think you are seeing already in some places, especially in my home country of Slovakia, is to really, I mean, make sure to, like, you know, do your homework domestically in terms of domestic economic policies and structural reforms to essentially play the first league with the big boys within Eurozone and the European Union. And there is, I would not underestimate the sort of reform churn, the ferment that you see in some countries, especially in places like Slovakia, where people really are mobilizing behind this idea of becoming a normal European country, finally, of no longer being a sort of you know, this sort of second class post-communist addition to the EU. I think it will take years to translate that into effective political action, but we are seeing that already to some extent. And I think, you know, countries like Poland are not that far behind. So I think that cultural force can be leveraged for the good. Is what I'm saying. It doesn't have to be just a drawback or a trap that keeps these countries as sort of, you know, troublemakers or make them sort of consider other geopolitical options outside of the West.
Yeah. All right. Let's turn to Emmanuel Macron. You have pretty recently moved back to United States after living in Paris for a while, and you was there. That's you were right. There during the sort of the rise of this political phenomenon, Emmanuel Macron. Do you think he is? Does he represent the type of ideas leadership that can put sort of Europe on the right policy track and be helpful in fighting noxious nationalism and populism that we've seen growing around Europe over the past decades?
As many, I have mixed feelings, mixed impressions of Emmanuel Macron. On the one hand, it's undeniable that the rise of La République En Marche and his own candidacy are illustrative of this broader change of Western politics, where France was in many ways ahead of others in establishing this political force that would stand squarely on the side of, you know, openness and cosmopolitanism and embrace of sort of creative destruction and so forth, and that would become the major cleavage in French politics. I also appreciate really the courage with which he pursued domestic reforms on a scale that has not been seen for many years in France. You know, from a sort of Anglo-Saxon Reaganite perspective, it might still seem like too little, too late. But by France's standards, taking on, you know, the national railways and reforming the labor code, et cetera, all within a very short amount of time, I mean, really amounts to big structural change, and I think it's going to bear its fruits in the years to come. What I'm less convinced about is him really having a strategy for preserving the open society, so to speak, on the European scale. So, you know, we saw that op-ed he published in all European languages or EU official languages this week. So we are recording this on the 6th of March. And that was supposed to be the sort of bold push for a pan-European reform. But in reality, it was a proposal for, you know, the creation of a handful of European agencies and then for some sort of great deliberative exercise that would hopefully lead maybe to changes in underlying treaties. And I think that's just woefully inadequate considering where the EU is. And it also, I think it was permeated with this mentality that Europe has something like to fear in the outside world, and that we should sort of organize our thinking and our policies around protecting Europeans against these sort of disruptions of the world, rather than immersing ourselves in the opportunities that this sort of open, dynamic global economy has to offer. I also worry, of course, that this sort of Europe talk, as is very often the case in France, is in the end a vehicle for petty French nationalism and sort of protectionism. And we've seen that in several instances. You know, the shipyards being taken over by an Italian company. Well, it was a step too, step too far. Whether or not that was compatible with the rules of the single market didn't really matter at that point. So Macron is certainly a figure to watch and observe carefully. but I don't really believe that a sort of single man can provide all the solutions to the continent. I think it's sort of, you know, exploring an uncharted territory and a space that is going to like play a big role, but I don't think he'll like fix things on his own.
And how would you describing in ideas terms? I'm asking because on the one hand he's presented as this savior of liberals in Europe, and he is highly appreciated by people inside the Brussels bubble, not least because he's one of few who indeed has provided sort of a pretty strong defense of European cooperation over the past couple of years. On the other hand, I mean, as you say, when you read that essay and this article that were published around Europe by Macron, what you see is a lot of traditional French dirigisme. You see an article that largely works the ethos of defensiveness, that he wants to it wants to change sort of the relation with a lot of countries in the world that either are almost sort of taking advantage of Europe because of the trade practices, or he wants to have stronger border controls, and he wants to defend Europe against digital platforms and all that. When you look at his own domestic record, you not only see someone who has been pursuing liberal economic reforms, but also someone that has been more sort of conservative or nationalist in his quest for national identity and his approach to trying to change the role of Islam and in France. Someone who almost have been taking pride in being tough on migrants, etc. So, I mean, it's a strange political personality in itself. So how would you describe him in ideas terms?
I think that's exactly right, the way you put it. He's a product of France's intellectual environment, very much a part of France's elite in every sense of the term. And this is sort of odd position for him to be the disruptor who comes from the outside to sort of reshape the political landscape, if he effectively is part of that landscape. Now, what really worries me is not just that element that you described, but also the overall attitude you see in his case and among many other well-intentioned people who want to defend and preserve the liberal order at home and internationally, where they sort of get into this sort of defensive mode, making the case for what is, what exists, and why it's been valuable, without really taking on board the extent to which the existing arrangements have not delivered for, you know, large swathes of the electorate. So I think we need, in many ways, bolder thinking and sort of more courage in sort of disrupting things, without really jeopardizing the elements that have worked. And I think we just like need to sort of move beyond the world of politics in some sense to find such ideas. I've been, for example, quite impressed by policy ideas coming out of the radical exchange circles. So Glenn Weil, who is a principal researcher at Microsoft, and Eric Posner, a legal scholar at Chicago, has published this book called Radical Markets last year that makes a bunch of proposals that really cross partisan and ideological lines very, very strongly. And I think it could like provide an interesting set of domestic reform ideas that we should take seriously and that really would force us to go out of our ideological ghettos and think more boldly about how market principles could be sort of applied together with new technologies to sort of reshape our institutions. I do believe that we need just much more institutional innovation than we currently are seeing. And I think Macron is in a way a prisoner of that he, I mean, you know, that's part of being a politician, I suppose. You are not an intellectual entrepreneur if you are running for office.
Yeah, no, that's right. All right, Dalibor. So finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about the upcoming European elections, or the election to the European Parliament in May. Here now, there's a pretty big debate between those who worry about a profound change in the makeup of the European Union as a consequence of nationalist populist parties doing well in the European election, and as a consequence of centrist parties like the centre-left and the centre-right performing very badly. Then we have others who think that we yet again have reached peak populism, and that even if these parties surely will make a gain in this election, they, you know, going to be far away from having any real influence on policy, and that we have gradually been moving to the point where there is a limit to how much they can grow, and that there simply isn't more voters out there that could be attracted to the type of message that they deliver. How would you see the politics of Europe leading up to the election, and what's going to happen afterwards?
I think I see it in the context of this broader realignment that we discussed, of the sort of open versus closed divide becoming more important. And that's true not just between parties, but also within parties. So I think some of the sort of electoral coalitions that existed in the past might no longer be viable. You see the debate already in the EPP about Fidesz and its position within the European People's Party. And so my expectation, I wouldn't really frame it in the terms of, like, you know, whether we are seeing peak populism or whether there is more space for populist groups on the left and right to grow. But the way I would put it is really through the terms of realigning politics, and in the process fragmenting it. So I think there'll be more political groupings in the new European Parliament. The position of the two large groups will be weaker, and I think those groups will potentially be less cohesive. And that will make governance in the EU at the level of the 28 or 27 member countries harder. The way forward, in my opinion, is really through coalitions of the willing, through some sort of, you know, variable geometry cooperation. It's not necessarily something I would wish for, but I think it's in a way inevitable that we'll sort of see a sort of disaggregation, perhaps, of different parts of the European architecture, maybe culminating in some sort of exit of the Eurozone from the European Union. If a sort of big push towards federalization happens within the Eurozone. But just this sort of, at the time of big political realignments, this sort of idea that 27 countries will elect representatives to this legislative or quasi-legislative body, and that you'll have a sort of coherent ideological party structure within that body, I think that's an illusion.
And do you see other forms of political entrepreneurship also coming here? So far, we have only seen new parties growing on the populist right and, to some extent, populist left. And then in the middle, we've virtually only one real example of political entrepreneurship that has been successful. And that, of course, is Emmanuel Macron. But it's, you know, going around in different countries in Europe today and watching the party political landscape there, you certainly get the sense that this is a highly cemented structure. It's tired. It's non-innovative. It's certainly past its sell date, but at the same time, there is very little new things that are happening, at least in Western Europe. It's a bit different in some of the Eastern countries, but at least in Western Europe.
I think that's true. But I mean, you know, Macron's own example shows that you can actually do entrepreneurship of this kind fairly easily and very rapidly. When things start moving, they will move very fast. In Slovakia, now that we are recording this, we are a couple of days away from the first round of the presidential election, where there is a candidate, a lawyer named Zuzana Čaputová, who was not in the world of politics, who is now being backed by two small startup parties on the center left and center right, who in some polls is commanding as much as 50% of the popular vote. And this is very much a new phenomenon in a country where there was a sort of grip on power by a small number of political parties. And now we are seeing, running up to the election, parliamentary election next year, a sort of complete, I think, reshaping of the political landscape, starting with this presidential run. So it's really a question of political organization, of finding good candidates, of mobilizing people. I mean, it can be done even in a place like Germany. I think it can be done. And not only it can be done, I think it will happen sooner or later. I don't think the current parties organized around interests and ideologies of the 1980s are going to stay around in that shape and form forever.
All right, very good. It's always good to end on an optimistic note, and I think that was an optimistic note, Dalibor. So thank you very much.
Thank Indeed. You, Frederick.
Thanks so much for joining us, Dalibor. It was a great pleasure talking to you.
Absolutely delighted to be with you. Thank you.
All right. And also thank you to our listeners. Bye-bye.